Blog Talk Radio.
Here comes the big bad wolf.
Sounds great. Big Bad Wolf by Robodrum. I love that song. Anyway, hey everybody, it's Christo Gonzalez. We're off kicking it off here. It's our second show. See how this goes. We're still trying to get all the little kinks out, get my feathers all smoothed out. I've got a format. We may not be exactly following that format just yet, but in future shows, and for those of you that want to come on the show, we're going to talk about things like what's fresh and tasty. We're going to explore what's in season now and what's going to be in season soon. We're going to have a little grilling segment with some grilling tips and techniques, as well as we'll talk about some rubs and smokes and marinades, things like that. I'm going to tell you what's cooking in my kitchen. It may not necessarily be about food. It might be what I've got going on. It could be about exactly what I'm cooking, what I have on my plate lately, what's cooking in my kitchen. And then we're going to have a section called Gotta Feed the Kid. And that's going to be my ongoing quest that I'm doing to create unique, simple, and exciting meals for kids. So we've got a little format. If you want to be on, find me on Facebook or email me at Christo2U@gmail.com. Christo2U@gmail.com. Now today we've got our first guest, Mr. Tim Cox. He's been playing with his food for 30 years, so he says. I don't know we'll figure that out. He's been installing telephone lines and video screens, and he's worked as a private chef and a caterer. He's from the South, so we're going to talk about our different cultures, what kind of foods he likes, what kind of foods mean Southern cooking, and I'll talk a little bit about my culture and New Mexico and Southwestern food and how that's how I evolved that a little bit into what I do here in New York. So, hey, Tim, you out there?
I'm here, Christo. Thanks for having me as your first guest.
How exciting, huh? This is this new technology stuff. I just get the biggest kick out of it. I often think about my grandfather, both my grandfathers, who were just amazed at how fast things were changing, even in their lives. But they would just be so shocked at how fast it's changed in the past 5 or 7 or 8 or 10 years. It's just awesome. Look, we're doing a radio show. Anyway, so, Tim, tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us about the South, Southern food, watermelon, fried chicken. Those are things people think of, right? You hear the South, you think okra, you know?
Absolutely, and you know, as a Southern boy and a Southern chef, you know, sometimes I really get a little bit tired of hearing, "Oh yeah, fried chicken and watermelon." I'm like, "Oh please." Southern food is considerably more than that, but to be honest with you, I'll mention it briefly in a minute. Both fried chicken and watermelon, as a fact, have quite interesting histories as far as it goes here in the South. But I wanted to start this off with a quote from a good friend of mine, Natalie Dupree, a well-known Southern chef and author, that runs pretty much like this. Southern cooking is primarily home cooking, not chef's art. It certainly ain't Nouvelle cuisine or precious. It's just good food, fit for savoring, not simply pretty to look at. And that's pretty much the way we look at our food culture here. Southern food culture is not so much about the food as it's the gathering of family and friends around the dinner table, around meal times. Growing up in a small town like I did in a blue-collar community, it was not unusual for once a week or every 2 weeks at max, to you were either eating at the neighbor's house with their family or they were at your house. And then when summertime came along, I mean, everybody gathered around the barbecue.
Well, that's what it does. Cooking builds community.
Exactly.
It's a big part of the building of the community. You can do it on big scale, small scale, you know, and if you're gardening, I'm sure a lot of people in the South have their own backyard gardens. I know I had that growing up in New Mexico. You know, you learn about the soil, you learn about the earth, you learn about where your food comes from, and that adds to the flavor profiles that you use. It just builds community. You know, when you're out there hoeing weeds with a bunch of people, you know, you kind of get a feel for what's happening.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in our neighborhood, we had a half a dozen neighbors that had, you know, really nice-sized gardens in their backyard. And you know, I think back on it now, and I remember probably one of the, I think it was the job of the children in the neighborhood, but you'd say, hey, I'm going down the street to visit with so-and-so, and your mom would hand you a brown paper sack with tomatoes or zucchini or something in it and say, well, take this down there. And then you'd have to bring the bag back, you know. So it was one of those. It's just one of those things that you did, you know, sharing the wealth in the neighborhood. And you know, one of the big misconceptions about Southern cuisine, to be honest with you, is that it was meat intensive and very fatty. As we called it back then, remember this was for blue-collar workers. This was for people that worked in the fields, the farms, the factories. So the meals were very hearty. I mean, a meat and three. There were more vegetables on the plate than there was meat because back in the day meat was not cheap, and so there would be days when literally your meal was vegetables. You know, so this whole concept that it was all fatty foods and, you know, fried and cooked to death, which there is, believe it or not, there is some truth to that, but it was not at the extent that people tend to think of it. There's a couple of or three really misconceptions about what was going on with Southern cuisine then and what it is doing now. The biggest being that everything was fried. Well, yes, the vast majority of our food was fried, but it was not done initially for flavor. It was initially done as a preservation technique. This goes back
they last longer?
Yeah, pretty much. It's basically when you fry it and you crisp the skin, it kind of seals the meat. This is a technique that actually has come to the world through various historical references from Scandinavia, Ireland. Here in the U.S., it was the Native Americans that taught the African slaves this technique, although Africans themselves also fried food in various parts of their country. But here, the way the Native Americans did it, they would fry rabbit, fowl, deer in barrel oil so that they could travel with it and they could hold it longer. So it was a preservation technique.
That's what you call confit right there. That's a confit.
Basically, yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a rich history behind how this stuff come into being, and the history has been lost, which is a shame, realistically, because you should know your food. You should know the history behind it. That gives you a greater depth of appreciation for what you're eating. One of those other little interesting side notes is greens and ham hocks. What people don't typically understand is that didn't come about the way people think it did. The way it actually came about, believe it or not, was when greens were fresh, in order to preserve them, they would be covered, layered in pork. Pork fat more particularly back in the day. Hogs obviously had more fat on them than they do now. And the meat was not actually used, but the fat and the flavors would get into the greens so that when they were cooked, you'd have a very, very flavorful, you know, pile of greens to eat on your plate. And as time went on, people realized, you know, they were cooking the greens too much and they were cooking out all the nutrients. So pot liquor, which was the cooking broth, became part of the meal, and everybody started eating the pot liquor. And you know, which is kind of a funny name in and of itself because, you know, obviously there's no liquor involved, and it's actually spelled L-I-K-K-E-R. But
interesting.
And then,
that's interesting.
You know, so then we started adding, when we weren't preserving greens like that anymore, then people started putting in ham hocks and things like that. But you would occasionally, when I was talking about not having a lot of meat, you would occasionally have, and Natalie had mentioned this also, but I lived in the same
time
period.
Hold on, let me set it up for a minute, because you said, you used the word preserving these greens. Now, when I think of preserving something, I think it's canned, I think it's on a shelf, and I think it's, I can come and get it in a week, 2 weeks, a month. How long, when you're just covering greens with pork fat, are you considering that they're being preserved for just a few days?
I cannot find a reference anywhere, Christo, that says for how long the greens would last doing it that way. Only the reference when I looked it up that that was a technique of preservation for them. I mean, obviously your big concern with using fat like that is rancidity. So I would say probably on preserve them for a week or two at most. You know,
at most. Yeah, you guys. There's a lot of elements there that would contribute to not preserved. You know, if you don't get all the air out, there's going to be air pockets inside of those greens. You know, you've got the, like you said, the rancidity of the meat, of the fat that could occur. I can't imagine that they would be preserved for more than 3 or 4 days. Most.
Yeah, unless, you know, that's pretty much the way I think about it. Like I said, I haven't been able to find anywhere where they actually define how long. Obviously, we wouldn't recommend doing that today, you know, it would just be bad practice. But back then, that was what they had to do, you know, and they used, and believe it again or not, that technique was one that came to us from the Native Americans. They were masters of food. They were highly reliant on having food fresh, and when they killed, and they had to preserve it for the seasons, you know. So we learned a great deal from them. Obviously, Southern cuisine is richly influenced by the African slaves that came to our country. They brought their own techniques, their own foods, and they learned from the Native Americans to substitute the vegetables and such that we didn't have, you know, that they didn't have here that they had in Africa, and how that's part of how okra came into the whole process. Okra was used as a filler, primarily in a lot of stews and dishes and such like that, because it's such a versatile ingredient. I mean, yeah, it's got a slime factor.
Well,
okay, I'll admit that.
No, I love okra. It's a thickener. You know, it's got that viscosity that makes it add thickness to soups. It, you know, the same way that you'd use cornstarch or filet gumbo, the filet. That works in the same way as a thickener.
Yeah, filet from the sassafras tree, when you grind it up and put it right on top of the gumbo and stir it in, man, that thickens up.
It thickens it up, yep.
That's some good eating right there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, things that people aren't using so much now that are starting to use more and more that will do the same thing. Chia seeds will do that. They'll add that same sort of thing. But anyway, I'm going to get back to the preserving and all that sort of thing. People used to hang up their meats. That was a common thing. So nowadays, that was, you know, the meat would get high. They would use that word high. Because it had a certain kind of a stronger aroma to it. Now, nowadays, I don't think people would be so keen on that, because they would think that it was not good. It was rotten. But, you know, there's that Rolling Stones song that where he sings that, you know, he's got nasty habits. He takes T3. The meat he eats for dinner must be hung up for a week. You know, you might remember those lyrics. Well, people used to do that. They'd hang that, and it really makes the meat more tender, makes it taste better. I know in New Mexico, I grew up on a farm, and we butchered animals. We had sheep and goats and chickens and cows and stuff, and we would butcher an animal, and we had this little adobe house off to the side that pretty much stayed a pretty even temperature all the time. And we wouldn't do it in the middle of summer because it'd just be a little too warm. But in the fall and the spring when it's cooler, we'd hang up the meat in there and let all those enzymes do their little job and break it down. And it really added a much nicer flavor.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we still follow some of those preservation techniques, and they've come from around the world. I mean, you have your prosciutto hams, you know, that are hung and air-dried. You have country ham, particularly in Virginia and down here in the South. One of my favorite companies that produces a particular type of country ham. They call it an attic ham, and it's aged for 9 months in an attic. And it is very tender, but the flavor becomes so strong.
Now, when I think of an attic, I think of a warmer environment.
It actually is.
Yeah, so they're aging this in a warmer environment. They're actually encouraging enzyme
bacterial growth.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Enzymes.
Yeah.
And
go ahead.
You know, one of the things about that, when you aged meat in that fashion, like Iberico pig or country hams or anything like that, obviously the outer layer serves to preserve the inner meat. But you're going to have a lot of loss when you trim that down to get to where you can, you know, the meat is safe to eat. You do have a tremendous amount of loss when you dry age like that. So that's just something you never want to eat the exterior of these products. But you're going to get very, very sick very, very quick.
Well, no, I'm sure it's probably a little off color as well, you know.
Yeah.
Now, you've got hams that are also packed in salt, right? That's another.
Yeah, that's an old curing technique, packing them in salt and like that. And the salt dehydrates the ham, obviously. But what you wind up with is a flavor that you're not going to find in many other products. Now, it's one of the things about southern hams, and particularly breakfast hams and such, that are just, there's something to them that you don't get anywhere else.
Now, I've had some of those southern hams. You know, they come like in a little bit of a burlap sack or something like that. Believe it or not, I've been down south. And I've bought a few things. So I've taken these hams, and I don't really know what to do with them after that. They're just so salty. Do you soak them? What are you supposed to do? Is it salt? Is the salt part of it? Am I just missing something that I'm supposed to like it that salty? Or?
Well, you know as well as I do that it's like using a brine. Salt's going to penetrate. But you can rinse most of the breakfast hams and such like that to remove a lot of the salty content. You can soak it in just cool water for a little while. It doesn't take long, you know, 15 or 20 minutes. And that'll remove a lot of the salt content. One of the reasons it's so popular here, particularly here in the South, is we like that salt. We like that salty flavor. I mean, a good slab of country ham for breakfast. Oh, man.
With the salt.
A little red-eyed gravy
could,
on top
could,
of that.
That could be a lot to do with the hot climate that you're in because, you're sweating a lot probably. You're losing a lot of your electrolytes and a lot of the salt, so you want to put it back in.
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't know.
And another thing.
That would be my good guess. Now, hold on.
Let me get back to the whole point.
Coca-Cola. You guys seem to use Coca-Cola a lot as an ingredient. I mean, those are another myths that I would imagine with the South is, you know, Coca-Cola in a gravy, right?
We do it. Yeah, Coca-Cola red-eye gravy instead of coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Coffee adds the bitter. Coca-Cola adds a sweet. You have the caramel and the sugar in the Coke, which adds to it. And Coke has been used pretty much since Coca-Cola came around as a barbecue sauce. You know, and we use we create sauces out of Coke and glazes and use them on hams, ribs, chicken, pretty much you name it. If you can cook it, you can probably put a Coca-Cola-based sauce on it. It cooks down, thickens up very well. It's, you know, every region of the world probably has a commodity like that somebody has created out of a locally sourced, created product. You know, whether you're using beer or ales or, you know, anything in your Irish stews or many other stews like, beer cheese soup, you know. So, you know, using alcohols and sodas and things like that's not uncommon. Obviously, there's a great many of them that will not work, but Coca-Cola, for its particular, the way it tastes automatically, it has a slight tartness, a little sweetness to it. It works really, really well for marinades and sauces and gravies and things like that.
Yeah, it sounds like it would.
Well, go ahead. Yeah, to get back to the whole meat issue that we were talking about, you know, and how meat will become a little skunky over a period of time, even if you have done some preservation to it. People wonder about the use of peppers, you know, hot peppers, high levels of seasoning, and this actually goes way back in time, back to the Roman Empire, as a matter of fact, where they used hot peppers and high-level seasonings like that to hide the flavor of meat that was spoiling, that was going bad. You don't see it anymore, but that's what it was originally all about.
Well, you know, you say that's true, that goes back that far, but I think in a lot of the more southern cuisines, you have the African influence from the slaves. So chilies and hot, spicy foods are used a lot in a lot of African cooking. And that's where the gumbos are coming from, that's where the okra is coming from, all that sort of thing was brought in at that time from that influence.
Yeah, a great deal of it comes in from there, and there's a piece to that puzzle that a lot of people leave out, and believe it or not, is the French Acadians. They brought a really rich culture of using peppers and spices and like that into Louisiana back in the day, and, you know, there's so many influences from around the world here in the United States. You know, everybody came here. And they brought their cuisines with them, and they modified them and updated them. So, you know, it's very interesting how things developed in different regions on opposite sides of the world, basically, you know. But then people,
mm-hmm.
you have to think back to the original spice trades, the original spice routes, how these things made it around the world. And, you know, I have to thank the Portuguese. Because they were virtually the first who ever made those oceanic journeys and brought all these wonderful spices and new fruits and new vegetables to the New World and also to Europe and that part of the world.
They're Mexican monedas that are made.
And that's well, and where that you have that sort of the French Acadian and the African influences. We have New Mexico and the Chile. I don't really even couldn't tell you how that happened. I don't know. It's in Mexico. They don't really eat so many hot, spicy chilies. I guess maybe there's that little bit of influence from the Aztecs and the Mayans from that particular area. But New Mexico has that same sort of history as the rest of the United States in terms of how it was settled. You know, it was people coming from the New World and settling and you know creating their culture around that. There was naturally the Native Americans were there and that all that sort of thing. But you know, I'm going to try to find out how chili. That's a good thing. I should probably know that. That'd be something for me to find out. Because we certainly do eat a lot of chili in New Mexico.
And I seem to recall, you know, remember the Spaniards came into Mexico very heavily. And if I remember correctly, something I read a long time ago was that they brought spices with them, particularly the paprikas, the peppers, and things like that. So, you know, that might have been part of the origin of using the peppers in the cuisine there as much as it is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, tell me more about, you know, your food culture in New Mexico. I'm really interested in that.
Well, it's just a chili culture. Beans, chili, simple foods. A lot of, you know, the influence from the Native Americans in that area with the corn and the beans and the squash. It was always just pretty much straightforward from the garden. You know, we would raise goats and sheep, and we would have that. You know, relatives would go hunting. We'd have deer and various other game meats that we'd have. I've taken a lot of that chili influence, and I've tried to kick it up a little since I've been living here in New York for a lot of years now. I've cosmopolitanized. I like to say a lot of my traditional things. Like I just recently made a reverse chili relleno. You know, I would.
Yeah,
I
saw that. That was a fantastic concept.
I could show that to any of my family members, and they would just think that I've just lost my mind. You know, what's wrong with just making a relleno. Why do you have to make it so complicated? But, you know, it's things have to evolve a little bit. It's more fun that way.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you.
You know, if we, you know, there's probably a lot of Southern recipes that I'm probably going to now start looking more into and seeing how we can fancy those up a little bit, you know?
Already, yeah, you know, some of the, back in the day, Atlanta obviously was not the food mecca that it is now. You know, when I was growing up, believe it or not, we had two steakhouses within 30 miles of where I lived. So, you know, in downtown Atlanta, well, it kind of shuts out at like 5 or 6 o'clock at night, and that, you know, that was the end of it. Today, Atlanta is well known as a food mecca. We have virtually every cuisine in the world probably represented down there. And, you know, the more interesting things you see is you go to some of the restaurants that serve, you know, traditional Southern dishes. They've taken a new take on it, much like what you're talking about with Chili Rellenos, where they will do like a braised pork jowl,
mm-hmm.
you know, which most people are going, pork jowl? Why would I want to eat pork jowl? Well, let me tell you something. Cooked properly, it's an absolutely fantastic experience.
Well,
you know,
I've been to Atlanta a number of times. I'm a Charbroil all-star with Charbroil
mm-hmm.
Grills, and Charbroil, you know, is right there in Atlanta. Well, they're in Georgia. We were working with the Weather Channel, and that's right there in Atlanta. But you have a market there that's like a world market. I wish I could remember the name of that place.
DeKalb Farmers Market.
It's got a mile-long aisle for every country in the world almost. It felt like
the DeKalb International Farmers Market is one of the greatest places you will ever walk into to find ingredients.
You wouldn't even imagine. You've got Ethiopia. You've got Morocco. It's world cultures, and there's an aisle. That place was impressive.
Yeah, and you get fresh fish there as well. I don't know if you've got back to the back of it, but they actually have fish in tanks.
What are you talking about? That fresh fish area was probably 80 yards by 40 yards long and big. It was huge. It was
get your net, get your fish. You know?
Yeah, my God, that was like a neighborhood. It was big.
Yeah.
The whole thing was huge. I would live there just for that store. That place was the most impressive place. And I've shopped around.
Yeah, and we love it. I mean, you go in there, you can find, if you cannot find it in the DeKalb Farmers Market, you're probably looking for the wrong ingredient, in my opinion. Just one of those things. But, you know, one of the things I've been meaning to ask you, though, is who influenced your cuisine, you know?
Say that again?
Who was your biggest influences on your cuisine?
You know, it's how silly it's going to sound. You know, I was like a little kid who raced off the school bus when I was a kid, raced, because I knew that the Julia Child cooking show started at 3 o'clock. The school bus dropped me off at 3:15. I caught the last 15 minutes of that every single day when I was a kid, running in, catching that show. So mm-hmm. I was influenced from growing up in my small town in Bosque Farms, New Mexico, to see, you know, these things. This felt like, you know, the bon appetit. It was so cool to me. So I would get in trouble a lot because I'd take the dish towels and just wipe things onto the floor, and my mom would get all mad at me. What are you doing? What's my dish stuff? I said, well, that's what Julia Child does. You know, she's got an entire staff and crew that are cleaning up after her. You know, and I said, well, Mother, that's your job. You're my staff and crew.
I know that feeling well.
So, you know, that influenced me. I watched all those little cooking shows when I was a child and watched that sort of stuff. I only just became a chef at the age of 40. I'd done a lot of other things prior to that. I'm self-taught. I don't know if a lot of people know that or not. I've taught myself, and I'm always learning. So it's I would just say I what influenced me is my desire to try things. I love Japanese food. I love French food. I like to try to mix those together a little bit. You know, it's the French style, Japanese simplicity of plating. It's hard to, you know, I'm kind of scattered. I love Italian food. I've been making my own pasta since the 80s. You know, I just love food in general.
No, you have to love food to be in this line of work. I mean, your greatest, I think the greatest pleasure that most of us get is the smile on the guest's face, you know, or on a family member's face. And they tell you, man, that was good, you know. And it doesn't have to be vertically stacked, you know. It doesn't have to be some of the frou-frou ingredients, as I like to put it, on the plate.
Well,
where
you know,
there's not enough really anything to eat. You know,
what I feel happy about in my stage now is my work and my pleasure have become the same thing. I'm doing exactly what I love to do. I do not regret a minute of work. I love it. So work and pleasure, they've now come together, and it's a fantastic thing. You know, we're at our time. How does this time go by so quick? I thought it was gonna be difficult, but we're there. We've
I told you.
I figured. You know, you told me it's because you're Southern and you talk slow, but that wasn't the case.
When you get good people talking about the same topic, it's easy to have a show. You know.
Anyway, I hope everyone's gonna tune in the future. Thanks a lot, Tim. It's been
my pleasure.
Great chatting with you. To you@gmail.com if you want to be on the show, or find me on Facebook. Thanks again, Brilliant Ideas Radio, for a wonderful format. We'll see how it goes here. Take two, or round two, ding ding. Got one more done. Big Bad Wolf.
Here comes the Big Bad Wolf.
Slow down your house, cause I see you acting.